Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Greetings and welcome to Dominic Diamond's Mind Palace, the kind of interstitial dreamscape void that occupies the space between Series 6 and Series 7 of Games Master. I am one of your hosts, Ash Versus, and normally this is where I'd throw over to my co-host Luke Owen, or more accurately, Luke would have done that first bit and then he'd throw over to me. However, Luke cannot be here this week, and so I've been joined by someone else.
And I am Cliff Foster, aka the amazing Cliff. Hello again. Wow. I'm back.
You're back and you're on the main timeline this time. This is no Patreon-only exclusive. By the way, if you want to hear us talk about Captain N the Games Master, sign up to patreon.com/underconsolepod. Yeah, you were always destined to be on this episode, and it was going to be me, you and Luke in a menage a trois, as it were. But now we're just holding each other by the hand.
Do you know what? It is an absolute honour, because I didn't, you know... And I never took this for granted. Never took it for granted that I would be asked to do this. So it's an absolute honour.
As it should be. As it should be. But this is our first between-season episode while we prepare for 1, the arrival of Series 7, 2, our second live show, and 3, the official Series 6 wrap-up episode. We are going to be taking a look at the UK launch of the Nintendo 64, something that took place merely a week after the broadcast of the final episode of Games Master Series 6.
In less than 48 hours' time, for 250 notes, you'll be able to lay your grubby hands on the most powerful games machine ever, the awesome N64. Already over 3 million have been sold in Japan and America since its release 7 months ago, and demand is quite literally outstripping supply. The three launch titles are the excellent Pilot Wings, the disappointingly clumsy Shadows of the Empire, and of course Mario 64, quite possibly the greatest video game ever.
So close to actually having a launch happen during the series. So close. But the Nintendo 64 arrived. It was here in the UK. Cliff, we've had our back and forth Nintendo 64 versus SNES, but we're not here for that today. We are here for the launch of a console that is really, despite our feud, near and dear to both of our hearts, but especially to yours with N64 Life. So What is your history with the Nintendo 64? Why do you love this weird console so much?
You're right. It is an odd console to be your favourite. I think a lot of casuals would find that a bit weird because of the titles that came out, but it is really an odd one. I sort of narrow it down because back in the, I want to say Christmas of 1997, on Boxing Day, I went over my friend Daniel's house. And Daniel had sat there the new Nintendo 64. And obviously, a lot of friends had PlayStations at that time. And I'd played on the PlayStation over cousins' houses and whatnot. However, sitting there for the first time and seeing Mario 64 as it was jaw-dropping. To see that open world and the music and the colours, going from me having a Mega Drive at home to seeing that was a bit, as I said, it was a bit of one of those moments that stuck with me. Now, fast forward to the September of 1998, I was taken to a Currys or a Dixon's or a PC World. I can't actually remember what the shop was at the time. However, we walked in and my mum said, right, you have a choice. This was going to be my first ever console that was mine. It wasn't family. It wasn't to be shared. This was going to be my first ever console to go in my bedroom and me just to play in my own spare time. And I had the choice of either the PlayStation or the Nintendo 64. And for some reason, even though most of my friends had PlayStation, I gravitated more to that N64. Because this was during my sort of teenage years, very much my development stages of going from that early teen to almost all the way through to the PlayStation 2 launch. You know, I got it soon afterwards when I was about 16 years old, I think it was. But going into that time period, that machine was there for some really big, important parts of my life. And it was not a friend as such, but these games, this console, there's a connection there. There's a connection with me. I can't really explain it. It's like when you have a book that you gravitate back to that book, no matter how many times you've read it. And with about 10 of these titles, it's the same with me. No matter how many times I go back and replay them, it almost takes me back to those years of being in my bedroom, listening to Mark and Lard, whilst having the telly slightly lower than Mark and Lard in the background, and playing these titles. It was such a big, important part of those teenage years for me.
What were those core titles for you? What were those titles that you just kept coming back to?
We're going to sort of do it in reverse order. I'll do my sort of top five. So, reverse order, Space Station Silicon Valley, a very open world game made by DMA Design, who would later become rock stars. But no, it was a very open world game where you would take control of these robot animals, and it was just so interactive and how or the AI interacted differently. Just one of those games it can really switch off to. Number four would be Mario Tennis, Mario Golf. These are really simple games that it taught me. So many games on this console taught me the rules of certain sports. I know that's bonkers, but I learned the rules of tennis through the N64. I learned the rules of golf through N64. I learned the rules of ice hockey for the N64. I used to get gravitated to those two titles. And then the top three. And these aren't just the top three games on this console. These are my top three games of all time. First one, Banjo-Kazooie. If anybody's listened to my show, you hear that amazing music made by Christopher Jordan Cook. And he took what I said to him of, I want music that, you know, has that rare feel to it, has that banjo feel to it. And he really captured that with the cheekiness of me. And then, yeah, so Banjo-Kazooie is a title that I keep coming back to. And no matter how many times I play it, it's just one of those titles that I can put 20 hours into quite easily. Second to last is one that I know that you love as well. And that is, if you're from the UK, Lilac Wars. If you're from the US or anywhere else, Star Fox 64. My party trick is that I can easily complete that game on the top run, mission complete, absolutely every single level, without losing a life. And I've done it on stream before to prove it. I can do that. It's one of my little party tricks, and it's just a game I absolutely adore.
I'm with you on there. You're absolutely right. I loved Star Wing, aka Star Fox, on the Super Nintendo. But there is something about those games, about that blend of characters, and of course with the original, and to a degree a little bit the second game, there was, in the character design, in the marketing material, there was kind of an ode to Gerry Anderson. Yes. And the Thunderbirds and the puppets and stuff like that, and the design of the spaceships, and just for the first game on the SNES, that opening title sequence, and then just Lilac Wars, aka Star Fox 64, just the absolute escalation of that. But I will contain my Star Fox love just for a little bit longer,
and I will contain the love for my favorite game of all time. And this is very cliche because it's a lot of people's favorite games of all time, but that's Zelda Ocarina of Time. Obviously not the first Zelda game I played. The first Zelda game I played and owned was Link's Awakening, but there's something about coming onto that Hyrule Field for the first time and it being a wow moment. And ever since, it is a game that I've constantly gone back to in my times of need. You know, that something very emotional happened to me last year. I lost my father. And the first thing I did when I came back to streaming, I was like, right, that is the game we're going to play. And it is always my comfort blanket. It's something that I can come back to time after time.
The video gaming chicken soup, as it were. It's the thing that just brings you comfort. Just that game that you just know you can go to. We've all got games like it, or films like it, or albums like it. But I do remember playing Ocarina of Time, and it's something we will also address a little bit later, is the status of role-playing games on the Nintendo 64.
Yes.
And it was a question mark for a long time, but Zelda came along, and while not a traditional role-playing game by many Japanese standards, it did show that this console can do big, epic fantasy.
Yeah, you listening, Square, it could do it.
I mean, I guess because there is a little bit of an age gap between us, or maybe just because I was already at least partially employed by that point. I want to say I was launch day N64. If not launch day, day after launch day. It was certainly one of those initial launch batches. HMV was sold out, Woolworths were sold out, Electronics Boutique or Game, I can't remember which one it was at that point, they were sold out. But those great catalogue bastions, Argos still had some Nintendo 64s, and I think I had one reserved, and I think that's how I still had it and was still able to get it the day after. And so I kind of went all the way up Cheltenham High Street, the main shopping district, and Argos was right at the end. I got my N64, and they didn't have Mario 64.
Oh, no.
They didn't have Pilot Wing 64. So my first Nintendo 64 game was Shadows of the Empire, an interesting game to start my journey with. I was fortunate at the time. I was very, very fortunate to have access to two current-gen consoles. Partly because while I was part-time employed, I was very good at saving, but I was very bad at long-term saving. So I saved up enough for a PlayStation, and then I had no money. And I saved up enough for a Nintendo 64, and then I had no money. To be honest, there's so many games I must have bought at the time, and I had them until I completed them, and then I traded them in. There are games I wish I still had, because they'd be worth a small mint if they were in good condition. But no, I wanted the next game, traded it in for 25 quid, and paid the difference.
So, if you didn't know already, I'm a massive fan of UCP. So when I found out that UCP was going to be a podcast, and I was a massive fan of Games Master as well, I'd listen to especially Series 1 and Series 2, and I'd go, I've got my N64 up in the attic. And I went up there, and I still had about 15 games, and I started playing through these 15 games. And literally, as you said, that thing of, oh, I wish I hadn't traded in games. That was all that was going through my head. I traded in Rogue Squadron. I need to get back Rogue Squadron. I traded in Space Station Silicon Valley. I got rid of that one. Where is that one? And now my collection sits at 136 cards. Japanese, American, and PAL.
And there's only like 393 games for the Nintendo 64.
That's NTC as well. It's actually only 295. If you were taking into account PAL. So let's put it like this. I can walk into any CX, usually in the country, and whatever N64 games they are selling, I already own. At least one copy of, because there's a couple of games I own two copies of.
I think one of the big selling points in Nintendo 64, and one I wish I had more memories of, is four players. Because this was a Nintendo console that went two controller ports. That's not enough. Let's make it four. It's something that Nintendo would continue onwards with the GameCube. But for the Nintendo 64, I mean, if we go NTSC and we include all the year increment games, there were, just shy of 400 games. Mm-hmm. Maybe only a quarter of them took advantage of that four player. And I don't know if that's just bad luck, if it's where certain developers didn't flock to the N64. Or was it because the Nintendo 64 tried to make four-player local work at a time when internet gaming was becoming a thing? It didn't hit its stride until the 2000s when broadband became a thing, but we've seen it on Games Master multiple times. Flight simulators, Doom, Quake, all those things going on. And so suddenly, bar one very key title for the Nintendo 64, multiplayer gaming was moving away from the sofa.
But at the same time, I think if you look at, let's say, myself, my age group, we were going over still sleepovers and things like that. You know, we were in our teenage years. Those with a PlayStation, I used to have to sit there and watch my friends play Resident Evil 2. However, if they came over mine, GoldenEye, four controllers in that slot, and you could just literally bang and it's straight on that screen. And I think that's where, you know, that there is this primeval love that I hear about the N64. People misremember certain games. It's quite funny how they misremember certain games as being either good or bad, but at the same time, it's how it made them feel at that time. Yes, the internet gaming phenomenon was just around the corner. However, this brought people together. And yeah, it's amazing that we were just able to then plug in a controller and go, and all four of them.
The one thing I wish I'd had more experience of, and I did have two-player experience on this game, is another subject matter close to both of our hearts, and indeed Luke's heart if he was here, professional wrestling.
Yes.
WCW World Tour, WCW NWO Revenge, then on to WrestleMania 2000, then on to No Mercy, and on the Japanese side of things, Virtual Pro Wrestling and Virtual Pro Wrestling 2.
There was going to be a sequel to No Mercy, but they sort of ran out of time. There was going to be called Backlash, but never was released.
But those wrestling games were, in comparison to the majority of wrestling games that have been sold to a Western audience, very, very simple to pick up, but complicated to master. You couldn't just go in and start doing immediate, like, kind of finishing moves and signature moves and power moves. You had to wear your opponents down. There was strategy. You had to rest. You had to breathe. You had to watch out because you could get knocked out. It was also a four-player game.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have tag teams, you could have rumbles, you could have free-for-alls, you could have other people controlling managers for outside interference.
Do you know one of the things that I loved about that game, especially No Mercy, well, it is No Mercy where they brought it in, a special guest referee mode, and the amount of times me and my friends would get into actual arguments of when somebody was the special guest referee, and it was one, two, and it was just this running joke. And every time, everyone would absolutely lose their stuff. Every time.
And then you had the other option. You could go with the guest referee mode of 1, 2, 3, done. Out.
Exactly. Just smack your left C button as quickly as you can.
I did get some epic 1v1 matches with my friend Mensky, a former guest on the podcast, because he was almost the fastest time, or almost the person to be interviewed for Games Master for the completion of Sonic 2. But I remember having at least one match, and I think it must have been on WrestleMania 2000, where we legitimately went an hour long. It was just back and forth and back and forth. I can't even remember who won. I probably lost, but I genuinely couldn't tell you who won for certain, because it wasn't the result that mattered. It was the fact that we shared that journey. And I wish I had more memories like that. I wish I had more memories of GoldenEye. I did definitely play it at some point with some friends. I guess for you, and maybe this is because you were slightly younger, you have that as a core experience.
I do. And actually, GoldenEye was one of my first games. And what I'm just showing you, because audio media, you know, don't help this, but I've got my original controller, which is a golden controller that I got on when I got my N64. And GoldenEye was one of those titles. It was the boxed-in game. So I had the boxed-in game. So I can't ever get annoyed with myself with destroying or losing that box, because I never actually physically got the box. It was almost in a plastic container in the actual box for the N64. It wasn't just the multiplayer with GoldenEye, even though that was what people kept coming back to. And it was how that was brought into the game was the most happiest mistake ever. It was literally moments before they launched the game, they went, should we stick just a random, you know, Quake-esque multiplayer into this? Ah, yeah, we can. Yeah, here we go. Rustle up some levels. Take away some of the detail. Fantastic. Get it out there for everyone to use. And that's what people remember. But that first player experience as well. Now, the game came out 2 years after the Bloomin' Movie. In fact, I think it wasn't long after the game came out that Tomorrow Never Dies came out. So the obviously sequel to GoldenEye as such. But it's amazing that even though that game came out 2 years later, it was the closest I think we've had. It was the closest that we had had at that point to living a movie. Like, I can't think of a title before that that was so accurate to the movie, but then expanded upon it. I think that people tend to gloss over that with the first player.
As fondly remembered as the multiplayer in GoldenEye is, there are some bits of it that are fundamentally broken.
Golden Gun.
The Golden Gun. Odd Job. And it does very much smack of, we threw this together at the last minute. That's not to say it's not fun. It's not to say it's not good. Please, I do not need those tweets and emails. But it is fundamentally broken. And you're absolutely right. The first player experience of GoldenEye for me has held up better than the multiplayer.
100%. Because there are actually better games on this console, in my opinion, as a multiplayer. For people in your timeline, let's stick with what I consider the best first-person shooter game on this console, and that is Doom 64. Because I have just heard a podcast where you two talk about Doom 64. It is, in my opinion, here we go, I'm going to get you some emails, the best first-person shooter on this console. Fantastic game.
It is a game I don't think it got the love it deserved at the time. I think that's been said by many people. I may have even said it on the podcast you just listened to. But I love that it's getting reappraised now. The fact is, I've got Doom 64 on this PC. I've got it on my Switch down there. I think I've got it on the Xbox downstairs. Because it is basically distilled essence of Doom.
Well, it was the best of. So they created that Doom as almost a, right, let's take what was brilliant about every single Doom we've made before and just put this all into this game. You said it in the previous podcast. You can just pick it up and play. It's no faff to it. Just pick up and play. And I was very, very fortunate for one of my viewers / listeners, a gentleman called Amorpha, who created me my own version, which is hysterical because instead of energy, they pick it up and it's Ribena, pot noodles, kebabs, and it's just very, very funny. I'm very, very grateful that I've got that ROM of it.
That is very, very cool.
It is very cool.
I've just thought of an analogy I wish I'd thought of before. Doom 64 is the Queen's Greatest Hits Volume 1
yes.
of Doom.
Yes.
Sure, there might be others. There might be a Volume 2 and a Volume 3. But for the most part, we all know Volume 1 is where the good stuff is.
Mm-hmm. No, totally agree with that. Because, as I said, it was made as a best of. And it has that feel. It's just taken every little bit that you loved about Doom 1, Doom 2, every single ROM that they were creating at that time. It's just taken all of that goodness and moved it into one game.
So anyway, back to the 1st of March, 1997, in Europe, in the PAL regions, the Nintendo 64 launching. It was quite a big launch, but I hate to be controversial, as a launch lineup goes, it felt quite meager because the console launched and it launched with three titles on launch day. Four, if you've got someone that broke street dates and released Turok early. But we had Super Mario 64, we had Pilot Wing 64, and the multimedia weirdness that was Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, which, as I said, it was one of my launch games. I've still got a soft spot for, not just for the game, which was okay, and let's be honest, without that game, we probably wouldn't have got Rogue Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not for the game that I love it. It's for the fact there was a comic, a book, an album, a calendar, you know, scented bath soaps and all that stuff. It was just that idea of, hey, what if we did all the tie-ins of a movie without a movie?
With Shadows of the Empire, it was great because, as you said, it was a multimedia experience. It wasn't just a computer game. LucasArts came to this agreement after Shadows of the Empire to produce three other games for the N64. And then, obviously, it continued on with Rogue Leader for the GameCube. However, going into Rogue Squadron, that became lore. So at the time, it's now known as the Expanded Universe. But what happened in Rogue Squadron also became lore. So it's a really good experiment, Shadows of the Empire, because it sort of led the way for computer games to really affect what, or especially Nintendo computer games, affect what is happening in that expanded universe of Star Wars.
But as a launch title for the Nintendo 64...
It's not my favourite Star Wars game of all time. And it's definitely not my favourite out of these launch titles. I would say it's my least favourite out of these launch titles.
Also, here we are with these launch titles. How many players is Super Mario 64?
One player.
Pilot Wing 64.
One player.
And Star Wars Shadows of the Empire.
I believe that would be one player.
Yeah. And you're shipping a console with four controller ports. And I know Turok Dinosaur Hunter was just around the corner, which, you know, two players, that's fine. But I see there maybe being the issue of, oh, well, the Nintendo 64's quite early in its life. Not everyone's got to grips with it. But this is March 1997. They launched in Japan in June 1996. Now, in Japan, the launch titles were Mario 64, Pilot Wing 64, and Sakayo Habushogi. Basically, Japanese chess, a shogi game. Those were the three launch titles. And I believe shogi was a multiplayer game, but it's not sexing up your console, is it really? Of the three titles, and as I said, I like Shadows of the Empire, Pilot Wings. Of course, I like Pilot Wings. Only one of those launch titles, Mario 64, is what you would call a killer app. There's not a Street Fighter amongst them. There's not, you know, Mario's holding this thing up. There's not an F-Zero.
And yet again, Rave Race, why isn't that a four-player game? It is only a two-player game. Even those that were pushed back, like the DMA design of Body Harvest, which I'm sure we'll talk about when we talk about RPGs in a minute, to Blast Corps, all of these games were just single-player experiences and really odd coming out from this console that was built for multiplayer experiences.
Despite a lack of software, the launch went well. The UK, where it went on sale for £249. Germany, 399 Deutschmarks. Spain, 34,900 Spanish pesetas. Finland, 1,695 Finnish marker. And Australia, $399.95. of Australian dollary dues. France, technically, 990 French francs. Technically. But it didn't come out on time for reasons that almost resulted in Nintendo closing, basically closing up shop in France and just going, nah, sod it, you're on your own. You can have, tell you what, Sega, Sony, you can have France. NEC, are you still shipping the TurboGrafx? You can have France. We're done.
He started just having to import these the consoles from Germany and from the UK because it got to the point of where, as you said, Nintendo just got to that point of, well...
As you said, the French retailers went, well, sacre bleu, we cannot get our own consoles, we will take their consoles. So imported them for other European countries and sold them at a hefty, hefty markup.
Absolutely ridiculous, the markup on it.
Three titles in Europe. Super Mario 64, we have talked about a lot on this podcast. For better or for worse, we've had two challenges. Well, one challenge, one murder. Pilot Wing 64, we had turn up just a few episodes before the end of Series 6. Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, we will never see on this podcast as a challenge. But talk about a future bonus episode. I wouldn't mind diving back into Shadows of the Empire, but just looking at the entire spectrum of the project, because I've got the book, I've got the album, I've got a whole bunch of the tie-in stuff still. And as I say, it's this fascinating concept of what if all the merch of a movie, but no movie.
And unfortunately, some of the multimedia stuff for this was actually a bit better than the game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the actual comic and the novel were really damn good.
It's one of those games, like I said earlier, that people misremember. Like the amount of times on a stream where somebody go, play Shadows of the Empire! And all I remember is fighting off against that blimmin' assassin droid and going, oh, great. Yeah, the wide range of weapons you get in this, a laser, fantastic.
And oh, then, that's the train level, isn't it?
It is, and the train level even before that, where you're jumping over the obstacles as you're zooming along. You're like, nope, where's Rogue Squadron? Even Battle for Naboo is a better game than this. It's like, ugh, so frustrating.
But great first level.
Yes.
If I can draw a direct comparison, that first level of Shadows of the Empire, the Hoth assault, the kind of like the prototype basis, if you will, for what would follow with the Rogue series of games of, hey, you're in a vehicle and you're recreating classic scenes from Star Wars. That has an almost Star Fox / Lilac Wars level quality to it of let's go.
It's that element of that we all were there. No matter when you grew up, you fantasized of reenacting those famous moments in Star Wars movies. A lot of us that are Star Wars fans will always say Empire Strikes Back is our favorite Star Wars movie. And that big scene, that big opening title, hit go and you're in it. You've got AT-STs in front of you. You've got probe droids. You've got the huge AT-AT walkers. And then it turns around to you and says, you've got to take them out and fire your little cannon behind you and go around its legs. It is literally reenacting that moment that we all did with our toys back when we were kids.
And then, unfortunately, the game itself falls off a fairly sharp cliff. I think it just had more ambition than it was able to realise. And it's not... It would be easy to point a finger at the Nintendo 64 itself because it wasn't the easiest console to develop for. It was probably somewhere between the Saturn and the PlayStation on the difficulty scale, with the PlayStation being so simple they could sell a consumer model that you could develop for. And on the other end, you got the Sega Saturn, which required a Rosetta Stone to sacrifice a goat and was, you know, couldn't do transparent polygons. For reasons. And then in the middle, you had Nintendo 64, which was not the most difficult thing to develop for, but, and it's something we've talked about in the past, the cartridge limitations. That was where it came down to. It's like, cool, I can throw a huge amount of polygons around, but they're going to be untextured or they're going to be low texture because I'm working, because the more textures I put in, the more expensive this game's going to be.
And the more music you want to pump in music into this game? Because you want to make it Star Wars, you want to add sound effects in there as well. Every single one of those lovely WAV files are just going to push down that memory and down that memory. Now, the cart thing, while we're on it, cart memory. It's always the thing that's brought up like by retro gamers to go, huh, why are you like the N64 cart memory? Right, there are a couple of reasons why Nintendo did stick this route. One of them was the word PlayStation. So as we all know, in 1991, Sony and Nintendo started to buddy up and create an add-on for the SNES, which was going to be known as the PlayStation, a CD drive that was being able to expand and make 3D games. However, during this development, Nintendo decided to sleep with another. They went to Philips. And with the Philips CDI, they went, oh, you created what? You did what with Zelda? No, we don't like that.
Biggest crab I ever caught.
It's a goma.
You're pretty good. Here.
Thanks.
That's a walk of shame.
And they went to Silicon Graphics to create the Ultra 64, the N64, and they went, we're sticking with carb. And I think that people forget that game, that Zelda game that is so heavily memed, is so vital for this system being cart-based. And it was, in the earlier games, that was its massive limitations. However, you see it as it gets later and later on. There's a couple of games out there that should no way near be on these carts. One of them I know Luke would have loved talking about is Resident Evil 2. That should not be on these carts. However, they started to expand their memory. They even looked into the basis of having two carts for one game. Banjo-Tooie, the sequel to Banjo-Kazooie, was going to be a two-cart deal. However, when you remove one cart to put in the second cart, you had to do it within 5 seconds. If not, that's it. Oh, you just lost everything. And also, as you remember, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this do, these carts to buy outright were 50 to 60 quid. Way back when, it wasn't cheap to get an N64 cartridge. So you imagine how much it would be to get Banjo-Tooie at that time. It would have been 110 quid for something that they can't figure out how to get the cart in and out. And I think that all comes down to that willingness of, oh, we need to expand. We need to get these games up to that PlayStation level. And I think you could bring that down to very much the case of them losing Square.
But for the launch of Nintendo 64 in Europe, Nintendo did push the boat out when it came to advertising. There was certainly a lot of press around it launching. There was a lot around Mario and Mario 64. I mean, we saw it a lot on this whole, like, kind of it being the first true 3D platformer game. Mm. And I remember seeing Mario 64 on the BBC News. I remember it being on, like, the Big Breakfast and, you know, all the, it was around, it was there. It did have a weird side effect, though, because you think about it, the time it launches, you had the PlayStation, you had kind of the Saturn, still, just-ish. You had the three people still writing into Games Master magazine about the Atari Jaguar.
They're now two. One's dropped off because the N64's it.
And then you had the Nintendo 64 arriving. And so Nintendo 64 arrived. It's got big marketing, big launch, woomph, sells out, despite a limited launch range of games. Saturn continues to go off a cliff. Jaguar, extinct. PlayStation goes up as well.
Mm.
PlayStation doesn't just continue to sell consistently, it actually gets a spike in sales when the Nintendo 64 launches because Nintendo made some noise. And of course, the discussion that was happening in the business pages, in kind of general television programming, as well as in gaming journalism, is it's a war. It's Sony versus Nintendo, PlayStation versus Nintendo 64. And also, especially as we get later in the year, which console should you get your kids for Christmas? So what you ended up with is you would have a generation of parents, or maybe older people, that would go, no, I've heard of Nintendo. I know about, I've used to play my Super Nintendo's WWF Super WrestleMania.
I've got one thing in mind, and that's to play some games, WWF Super Nintendo.
But Sony, they made Walkmans. And so the PlayStation got even more mainstream press, and it resulted in their sales going up through the roof. But despite kind of boosting the enemy's sales figures, Nintendo 64 was no slouch. It was the kind of second place for the 32-bit generation, despite being 64-bit. It was the second place of that generation and kind of outlasted the next console from Sega as well with the Dreamcast, which is absolutely crazy. Although Sega with the Dreamcast did ape what Nintendo had done, four controller ports along the front.
They had made sure that, yeah, they made sure that one was copied, which helped people out that when they wanted to buy a copy of Power Stone.
Although I do love looking at my Dreamcast and going, okay, you copied four ports from the Nintendo 64, and then I put my Dreamcast next to my GameCube, and I'm like, it's like a brutalist shrunk down Dreamcast.
It is, to be honest. And funny enough, it's big titles the GameCube would later get anyway.
Nintendo 64 is the fastest, most powerful games console on Earth. And at $149.99, there really is no contest. Get into it.
And see how it feels when 007 meets N64 before Bond returns in his new movie Tomorrow Never Dies. Nintendo 64, the fastest, most powerful games console on Earth.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
23. Big businesses now merge with alien nations. The president is about to be cloned, and it's your job to try and save the world. So what are you going to wear to work? From the creators of GoldenEye for N64, meet Special Agent Joanna Dark in Perfect Dark.
And here they come! Smell that rage! They're steaming into the straight, showing no mercy! Oh, this is getting very nasty! Oh, he's out of it! I bet that hurt! He's losing!
Mario Kart 64, take it on head-to-head with split-screen action four ways.
Just who is in control here? They're taking no prisoners!
Get the anger out of your system with Mario Kart 64 and keep road rage off the streets.
Oh, this is ugly!
But with Games Master off the air as launch, we are left with Games Master magazine. Although, to be more specific, it's actually 64 Fan magazine, which was the kind of insert magazine that appeared in Games Master magazine first before launching as its own standalone title. But it is where the majority of the N64 launch news appears for this issue. The magazine insert is given over purely to the UK launch of the Nintendo 64, which has the headline, Saturday, March 1st, let the games begin. And they proudly proclaim, we've got our hands on the PAL machine. So what we have are some not terrible photos of the staff of 64 Fan magazine with a PAL Nintendo 64, which basically means you've got a cardboard box. And I'm sorry, but I thought the Japanese box was much nicer.
I really
like the kind of the purples and the blues of the Japanese box.
It's almost like electric, and oh, it's like the different colours around the outside. Oh, it just looks like when car fans put lines on their cars because it makes it go quicker. It looks really nice. And to be honest, Nintendo, all the way through, even the cart boxes, they're so much nicer. They're always so much nicer than what we got.
But we get pictures of the box. We get pictures of the staff members cuddling the box. We get a picture of someone reading the epilepsy warning pamphlet. And we actually get the information here that on day one, there were only 20,000 Nintendo 64s available in the UK.
It's that supply and demand thing, isn't it? And they've always done that so well. Always done it so well. And remember, Luke only said in the last podcast, obviously, what happened on the Wii launch.
But the text begins, so what do you get for your fine English pounds? In the eye-catching box modelled on the US packaging, all that's been changed is the removal of the tagline, the fun machine. You get a bulk of black kit. You get the machine, the power supply, and a pad, complete with plastic lump towards the end of the wire, its main purpose being to act as a stress reliever, so that if you yank the wire out, you're not going to pull the wires out of the connecting end. Now, that's bollocks. That's not what that lump is for. That lump appears on all controllers that are to be sold within the European Union, and it's a ferrite core, and it's also on a PlayStation pad, and it's also on other pads, because you can actually tell the difference between different regions of pads as to whether they've got that ferrite core on. So it's not a stress reliever. That's bobbins, mate. I mean, that might be a kind of tertiary benefit, but it doesn't make much sense. But they also say you get an RF adapter and the relevant leads. The adapter slots into the multi-out port. The SNES has one as well, just next to the RF out at the back. It wobbles a bit when it's plugged in, but it's a solidly built little box, enables you to plug your RF leads into your TV and Nintendo 64. There will be all the regular multi-out variants released soon though, including an S-Video lead and SCART adapter, so keep your eyes peeled. I do not miss the day of those RF cables.
See, mine is all plugged into a Elgato, so I obviously bypassed all of that.
But boxing out from this little launch piece, which really doesn't actually tell us anything new other than something that is probably categorically false, we also have a note about Turok Tuesday. Acclaim have at last confirmed their Dinosaur Pack Doomer-Up, reviewed earlier this issue, will be launched in the US on Turok Tuesday. Not quite as catchy or irritating as Sega's Sonic Tuesday, but it still captured the imagination of US gamers, with flies in the major US mags hitting the message home. We at Nintendo look forward to the March 4th launch of Turok, said Howard Lincoln, chairman of Nintendo of America. We're convinced it will play a key role in broadening the N64's market penetration in 1997. Howie, you faintly rude bloke. And it was a very important game, but it came to attracting a more mature audience because Turok Dinosaur Hunter was not your standard children kind of targeted Nintendo game. It was one of those, it was a very early title that was designed for a more mature audience.
Actually, do you know what? We'll go on to the controller because I'm sure we can say a lot about the N64 controller, but it was definitely a weird game on that aspect of that it was one of the first games I knew of that it would use C buttons to control moving backwards and forwards and then use the joystick to look around. So almost what we would get with latter-day games with the double joystick. So it would almost work similar to how a Call of Duty would nowadays, more than a GoldenEye that would use just the joystick. So one, it did lead to that sort of mature audience because obviously it's got dinosaurs and knives and bows and arrows, and no matter how much of a foggy day it is, it's not Silent Hill, it's always a Turok day. I think that's one of the things that really fascinates me about that game. It's one of the first games I really remember using, almost as I said, a double joystick.
Or mouse look. That's what it is. It's the idea that you actually have the buttons which will make you go forward, strafe left, straight right, backwards. Yeah. And then the thumb pad, or the thumbstick rather, the nubbin, as it were, on the N64 pad, that's the mouse look. But yeah, Turok, it's a great game. But back to N64 fan, there is a brief little box out about Borders because, much like the SNES, the Nintendo 64, Borders, it had some. It definitely had some. Nintendo did try and say, they're barely noticeable. It runs at exactly the same speed. And, well, they are noticeable, and it does not.
I'll be, obviously, being an N64 collector, I know that there are collectors out there that have sold every single PAL cart they have and just concentrate on NTSC because of the speeds of the PAL. There is considerable slowdown with a lot of those games.
The ones, to go back to the wrestling titles, the four-player wrestling titles as well, which suffer from slowdown because of just slowdown of pushing the hardware too hard, you then take the NTSC PAL slowdown into it, and there are moments where it's like kind of like grappling through treacle.
Yeah, it's there's even moments in, you know, titles such as Banjo-Kazooie where you, come on, you can do it, yeah, that's it, up to normal speed. There are moments where you have that, even in Banjo-Kazooie, and that's a title that came out in 1998, so...
But if we go down the side here, we do have a Holy Cow column, which gives us a little bit of sales info update for the other regions Nintendo 64 is actually on sale, so not France. And they say, since its launch in September of last year, the N64 has sold a staggering 1.7 million units in the US. According to Nintendo, their console sold more in the first 3 days of the release than the whole of the current Saturn US user base. That's sadly believable.
No one's questioning it.
With Japanese sales at over 2 million, Nintendo fully expect to have flogged 6 million N64s by the end of March, 1 month after the UK and European launch.
It's not bad going. They sold 5.8 in their financial at the end of the financial year for, and that was April. So that's actually pretty accurate.
We also have some details of launch events going on around the UK. HMV are seriously gearing up for the launch of the Nintendo 64 in stores across the country. There will be competitions aplenty to win a brand spanking N64 on the day of launch, although you may have just missed them if you're reading this after March the 1st. At the Filthy Great Level 1 in London, there will be a grand prize draw between the first 64 people into the store on the Saturday morning. The winner gets their own N64. So chances are they were going to get it anyway. It's just whether they have to pay for it. There's also a Star Wars exhibition to promote Shadows of the Empire. It will feature all the major spaceships, characters, masks and the like provided by cult shop Forbidden Planet, and I'm sure you could buy those for exorbitant prices. And there will be challenges running to win an N64 using Wave Race 64, Mario Kart 64 and Shadows of the Empire, with runners-up prizes of groovy Star Wars and N64 gear. The HMV stores in Manchester, Glasgow, Newcastle, Leeds, Liverpool and Birmingham will also be offering the chance to win an N64 with all-day game challenges on various N64 titles and merchandise giveaways. Sounds like it'll be a right royal laugh. Get yourself down there and treat yourself.
Shame we read that after it, you know, 25 years after.
Yeah. We
could have got down there, damn it.
I mean, most of those HMVs aren't there anymore.
Oh, depressing times.
And if they were there, they'll be selling Funko Pops.
We need currency for the apocalypse, all right?
Any new console brings about a lot of potential owners who will have questions, and this magazine has set to answer a lot of those. 20 frequently asked questions are answered to varying degrees in this feature. I'm not going to go through all of them because some of them are just repeating information we've already said many times over, including talk of black borders and what do you get for your money. But there are a couple of questions which are worth highlighting. First of which is question number 3. Will the big companies like Capcom, Konami and Namco be making games for the N64? And the response is, yes siree, Konami will have the absolutely splendid Perfect Striker out here in April. Probably retitled International Superstar Soccer 64 or something like that. That's exactly what it was retitled.
Literal.
Capcom have all but confirmed a Nintendo 64 version of Ghouls and Ghosts, and Namco are working on a couple of sports titles and a role-playing game. Suffice to say that nearly all the major Japanese publishers and developers have signed on Nintendo's dotted line and have projects bubbling along. A few questions later, will the add-on disc drive thingy just end up in the bin like the Mega CD?
It was gonna sell worse, believe it or not.
Well, the answer given is not if Nintendo can help it. They're making sure that it's a lot more than just a way of storing bigger games. A certain proportion of the disc can be used for saving information, making games much more customizable. There's talk of Zelda 64 coming on some sort of cartridge disc combo, the disc being used for extra scenarios. They're also giving it some other top titles to ensure its success. Super Mario 64 2, the RPG Mother 3, probably ending up here as Earthbound 2, and Super Mario RPG 2, are all down to appear on the 64DD, or as it's now being called in Japan, the Nintendo 64 disc system, because someone told them that the other thing sounds like a big bra.
Well,
that last bit wasn't in the magazine. That was just me.
That was just you. Yeah, the 64DD. Well, that was a thing. 100,000 of them made. Only 15,000 of the blinking things sold. There are still boxes being found in North America and Japan just full of unboxed. Oh, that's a goldmine. Because even to buy one nowadays, 1,000 quid. You found one of those unboxed? Oh, that's you set for life.
There's a question about how much games will cost, where they sheepishly admit 60 or 70 pounds for some titles. Ow. Question 10 gets a little interesting with, will I be able to get an adapter to play my SNES games on the N64 like they did with the Super Game Boy thingy? To which the answer is basically no.
No. Obviously, there are peripherals on the N64 launch later on, especially coming out as a tie-in with the Pokemon Stadium, the UK relaunch of Pokemon Stadium, not the Pocket Monster Stadium that was launched a year before. So that Western launch came with the transfer pack, which you can pop Game Boy games in there and play on your lovely N64. However, not all Game Boy games. They had to be connected to the cartridge that you were playing. So, for instance, Pokemon with Pokemon. There was a Perfect Dark game that you could play as well. like literally that transfer pack, it was such a good idea. And actually later on, they made use of that technology in the GameCube. I've got a Game Boy Advance adapter at the bottom. So they made use of that to be able to play all of those games. However, no, you can only play those select titles.
Question 11 is the elephant-sized chocobo in the room. We've all heard the story about Squaresoft ditching Final Fantasy VII on the N64 in favour of the PlayStation. And now Enix are doing the same thing with the other top RPG, Dragon Quest. Does this mean that the N64 is just no good at role-playing games?
It's sad, because in all of the tech demos, they had a version of Final Fantasy VI in Japan. A 3D version of a fight happening on there, and we never got to see it. And it made Nintendo do some really weird things, because we'll go on to something they had success with, as you may have alluded to a bit earlier on. But it made them do really, really strange things. Now, if all of you have listened to Games Master, you will know that they got one of the best exclusives, I think, has ever happened on UK television. And that was the exclusive from the Shishinko show that had only happened that week. And it went live. And we saw certain games get announced, like Bulldozer 64, which then would become Blast Corps 64. But one of those games that was announced on that was Body Harvest. Now, Body Harvest was a game being developed by DMA Design. That was being announced back in 1996. It's because you do that. Because you go, Luke, guess what? I was just about to say that. Ash, guess what? Guess when that was launched?
1998? End of 98?
Bang on. End of 98. And that was because Nintendo kept on going to DMA Design, creating this open world game, which would be fundamentally their test dummy to Grand Theft Auto 3 that would later come out when they became Rockstar. They were using this to create this open world game, and Nintendo kept on going, could you turn this into an RPG? DMA didn't want to do it, but they didn't want to lose that Nintendo contract that they had. And literally they were like trying to convert it. Nintendo just kept on coming in going, yeah, that's great, but can you turn this open world game into an RPG? And that's what kept on pushing it back. And that's why it is very much a loved game and very much has a really big cult following as an N64 game. However, that's why it's sometimes a buggy mess, because Nintendo kept on sticking the oar in going, could you just do what Square were going to do or Enix were going to do? Could you do that for us?
The answer that they give is time to stomp on this rampant rumour once and for all.
Oh no.
Purely by their nature, RPGs like to have a lot of space to play in. Loads of locations, characters and storylines all eat up precious space. If you add that to the desire to do the whole thing in sumptuous, go-anywhere, memory-hungry 3D, then you're asking a lot of any system. Square decided it wanted incredibly detailed backdrops for Final Fantasy VII. Pictures like this take up a lot of room, something which CDs have and cartridges don't, so it was natural for them to turn to a CD system. Enix obviously agree, hence Dragon Quest VII will also be on the PlayStation. All of this doesn't mean that the N64 is bad at RPGs, just that if you want them all to be huge, great epics and in 3D, you'll probably have to hang on for the 64DD. There will be cartridge RPGs, Imagineer working on one, but don't expect them to be on the scale of Final Fantasy VII. Oh, and one more thing, Square haven't deserted Nintendo completely. If they come up with a viable N64 project, they'll do it. And why are you bothered about Dragon Quest anyway? There's only one that's ever been translated into English, and that was on the 8-bit NES.
Square wouldn't come back until the GameCube.
When they did actually give me one of my favourite Final Fantasy games, I bloody love Crystal Chronicles.
Oh, yeah, it's a good one.
But especially with the Game Boy Advance Link Up.
There were so many games with that, but that's a podcast for another time.
We skipped past some questions about some hypothetical rich kid that owns the PlayStation, the Saturn, and a PC with a 3D accelerator, so whether they should actually get the Nintendo 64. Another question about running import N64s in the UK and what is required to do it, which is nice that Games Master is actually addressing that and giving some details, talking about converter boxes and standard converters that Daytel produce, so that's cool. But then 14, again, slightly more negative question, but it is one of the ones I remember being bandied around a lot at the time, which is, surely Nintendo 64 games won't be as good as those on the PlayStation and Saturn because cartridges can't hold nearly as much information as CDs. Do Nintendo think we'll put up with smaller games? And the answer is no. It's a myth that just because a PlayStation game comes on a CD that can hold up to 650 megabytes of data, that it always uses up the whole disc. It may come as a shock, but the game code for Ridge Racer only takes up about 3 megabytes, and would easily fit with hoofing great space to spare on an N64 cart. What you won't get in a Nintendo 64 game is a great long pre-rendered intro sequence, which is where most of CD game space goes. I'm not sure I believe Ridge Racer fits on 3 meg.
No.
The code may, but not the textures.
Ridge Racer 64 is nowhere near as good as a Ridge Racer, the original Ridge Racer. You look at Wipeout. Wipeout can take the music files. It's a good game, Wipeout 64. Incredible game. Brilliant game. So immersive. It's beautiful. However, they had to completely cut out the music sections from that because it couldn't take those music files as well. No, that's not right.
That answer does come off as very defensive and very much someone that's swimming about in a river in Egypt. And then the last couple of questions are questions about whether you can link up machines for multiplayer experiences, something Nintendo 64 never really dabbled with in the same way the link cables did for the PlayStation and similar. Release windows, saying that basically, yeah, we're still going to get stiffed on the gap between the US and Japan and the UK for a lot of games. Although it does point out, Turok is almost a global release. So take that for what you will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the last questions is about Nintendo and the fact they used to be against violence. Will N64 games be all fluffy, cute and nice? And apparently that one was from Les. And they point out, no, Killer Instinct, Turok, Mortal Kombat, all featuring bucket loads of the Crimson Fluid.
However, Miyamoto's idea for the end of GoldenEye was funny. Do you know of that one?
No, I don't.
So basically, Miyamoto, after seeing Rare's beautiful design for GoldenEye, went, can they all hug at the end? No joke, he wanted all of the characters to combine at the end and just have a big hug.
It's so weird that he comes up with that for the ending of GoldenEye, based on a film which is relatively violent. And then when it comes to making a Mario movie, it goes to the makers of The Killing Fields. Did he send the wrong memos to the wrong people?
And he can travel through space and time.
19th question is, will the Nintendo 64 be a success? And the answer is essentially, who do you think we are, Mystic Meg?
This is very defensive.
And it does say the N64 broke the million sales barrier in both Japan and the US faster than either the Saturn or PlayStation. I'm not going to get into that bun fight. I mean, you're pulling a face as well, which means I don't think we'd argue over whether that factoid is a little bit pony.
I think that's someone's messed about with some figures there, a bit WrestleMania style.
Unless you get annoyed if you can't buy more than 5 blockbusting games a month, you should find the release schedule more than adequate. Let's talk about the definition of blockbusting games, because launch titles, that ain't there. If we take into account Turok, if we allow for the street date breaking, then there are arguably 2 blockbuster titles within the first couple of months.
Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the year and a half that followed, there was only really a handful. And then it was 1998 that you saw the explosion of games, the summer of 98, that you had the Banjos launch, and literally all of those titles that people tend to go back to were 1998, 1999. That was the sort of 2 golden years for this console.
The last question is an interesting one because, like a lot of these questions, it's very loaded. I'm thinking about getting an N64 because all the games that get released on my PlayStation or Saturn seem to be either 3D beat-em-ups, racing games, or Doom clones. Will Nintendo 64 titles be any different to this? I mean, really different.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. There were some truly innovative games for the Nintendo 64.
There were.
The problem is that the reason why there were so many Doom clones and 3D fighters and racing games released on other consoles is because they're popular,
mm-hmm.
because they're accessible, because you know that if you liked Ridge Racer, there was a chance you'd like Wipeout. If you liked Wipeout 2097, there was a chance you would like Gran Turismo. If mm-hmm. you liked Tekken 2, you might like Soul Edge, and so on and so forth. Whereas looking at some of the games that came out for the Nintendo 64. One of my favourite games, Blast Core.
Mm.
Buying that game was a gamble.
It was, and making that game, it was... Like, name me another game that involves, oh, well, you have to knock down a node of buildings so this truck with a nuclear bomb can go through. It was just, it stands out. Like, I did, like, on my podcast, I always do game versus game. And I wanted to do Blast Corps, and it was really hard to figure out a game that I would do alongside it. It is so unique.
Their answer is, it's a bit of a cop-out. Developers only make games that people want, which is in line with what I kind of just said. You may moan about yet another Street Fighter, but it's still very popular, and it would no doubt make a lot of Nintendo 64 owners happy if they had a stonking version for their own machine. There will be original games, as there are on every system. Don't be surprised if many of them are severely souped up 64-bit versions of old faves. Supply and demand, matey. Now, I would argue that if there were more souped up 64-bit versions of old favourites on the N64, the gaming landscape may have been slightly more different, because mm-hmm. we never got a Street Fighter.
And the sort of first 3D fighter that hit was Mortal Kombat. Well, excluding, obviously, Killer Instinct Gold, because it wasn't really 3D, was Mortal Kombat 4. And then it only got, in my opinion, excluding Smash Bros, because Smash Bros is a genre of its own, a sort of traditional fighting game. It had Fighter's Destiny 1 and 2. They are made by Ocean, of all people. They were the only, I would say, decent 3D fighters that this had. It was almost screaming out for a Street Fighter to come and fill that void. And it's really, those sort of genres, it was very still, very Nintendo. It was very slow on that uptake of, oh, let's actually make series that people really, really want.
I mean, let's be honest, Street Fighter would never have worked on that controller.
There is a reason why I am this controller. So I am showing a Brawler 64 controller made by Retro Fighters. This is my controller of choice because this is better for a majority of games. But the reason why it's called a Brawler 64 controller is it's so much better with fighting games. So much better with the Mortal Kombat trilogy or Mortal Kombat 4. Because of the positioning of the controller, because that nubbin in the middle was a pain in the arse. It wasn't built for it. It was built for anything Nintendo made by themselves. I can't play Lilac Wars / Star Fox 64 without a traditional controller. Mario 64 was literally built for that controller. Literally even with the C buttons doing the camera angles. However, there's only a handful of games. Nine times out of ten, they are Nintendo-made games.
We move into the looking ahead section of this little magazine, looking at the post-launch timeline, and that includes both games and peripherals. The memory pack, the controller pack is there. Obviously, all Nintendo 64 titles that had a save game functionality saved to the cartridge. It was the one advantage of a cartridge over a CD in that you could save data back to it, although the save game feature did actually increase the cost of the cartridge, and by making it mandatory for games to save to the cartridge, all cartridges were going to be more expensive as a result. So, bit of a thing. The Jolt Pack, which for me, Star Fox 64, can't imagine playing that game for the first time without it. Controller colours.
So I've got the traditional grey controller and I've got the golden controller. And then latter releases were a red and a blue and a yellow, I believe.
They
were
a black and a green as well.
Oh, there was a black. No, there was definitely a black. I think the green didn't come out in Europe or US. I might be wrong there. However, I can't remember it. The black definitely did.
But I've definitely got a red controller downstairs, and I think a yellow one or maybe a blue one. I've got more than just the grey controllers, put it that way. They also list bits and pieces coming out from Daytel, including a version of the Action Replay, a supersized memory card with one of those little buttons that would let you flip between the different sets of storage, and those things always corrupted in the end. They were terrible. Yep. The last piece is something that very much of its era, because they existed for the Nintendo 64, they existed for the Super Nintendo before it. The Doctor, in this case, the N64 Doctor, basically a, hey, copy games to a floppy, or a CD, or in one case, I think a zip drive. I think there was at least one version of the 64 Doctor or a similar device that used zip drives.
To be honest, if it wasn't for those being created, you know, if you look at, let's say, the expanded N64 library, which are so many modders out there, so many modders creating amazing titles. If it wasn't for that, it would have been, yeah, it's a pain in the ass to get those ROMs from those carts. So, but it always made me laugh because they were always sold on the basis of, you can expand the game, you can make the games bigger. No. You're just ripping the game off. Stick it on some blank cart.
They don't beat around the bush on this one. They just say, it's the shamelessly dodgy N64 cart copying device we told you about last month. It's called the N64 Doctor, costs $400, and allows the unscrupulous to copy cartridges onto a writable CD-ROM, making illegal games a good £40 cheaper to buy than legal shop-bought carts. Boy, blank CD-ROMs used to be bloody expensive. Anyway, they go on to conclude, the unit even has room for memory upgrades to take in any increase in the storage size of games. And what's more, the shady Hong Kong geezers who manufacture it are setting up an internet-based help service for their unlawful piece of kit. Nintendo have always been stern defenders of their copyright in the past, and it'll be interesting to see what they can do about this one. The answer is, not a lot. Now, there is also a feature on the 64DD. That is a very, very long-winded thing to discuss, so we are going to skim over that. Maybe we will come down to it down the line. I noticed a complete absence of the expansion cart. No mention of that there.
Yeah, so the expansion cart was known of from 97, definitely from 97, because Acclaim had already started to develop its successor to Turok, Turok 2 Seeds of Evil, which was able to connect to it. LucasArts was able to get in there as well. Obviously, it was an expansion for Rogue Squadron. And then Rare famously messed up, because if we know about the expansion pack, they made Donkey Kong 64. Now, I'm saving that for a whole podcast by itself, because I could sit here and moan all day long how that's a massive collector bomb. However, Rare decided, let's use the expansion. Oh, Nintendo, what? We created a game, yep. And do you know that peripheral that you could sell for like 50 quid? Yeah. Well, our new game can't run without it. What? Our new game won't run without it. Oh, so we were asking, can we give it out free with Donkey Kong 64? Because if not, the biggest title of 1999 won't run. And yeah, it just always made me laugh is that Rare completely messed up. The darlings of Nintendo at this point completely messed up their peripheral that could have made them quite a bit of money.
So just to wrap things up, looking at this N64 launch and what's ahead in the wilds of 1997, 64 Fan has given us 4 pages of titles to look forward to over the coming months and years. So what I'm going to do, rather than go through the paragraphs and paragraphs of information, I'm just going to read the titles to you. And as our now resident N64 expert, I want you to give me your gut reactions, your immediate thoughts, or your lasting one-sentence memory of those games.
Go for it.
Start with an easy one. Zelda 64.
What would later become Ocarina of Time. Beautiful masterpiece.
Star Fox 64.
The most enjoyable game you'll ever play.
Wave Race 64.
The water physics are... You don't get anywhere close on a console for at least 10 years afterwards.
Yoshi's Island 64.
Yoshi's Story, showing a Japanese copy of it. It is relaxation in a cart.
Kirby's Air Ride.
Somebody is sat on that ROM and we all want it. Give it to us. Later came out for the GameCube. Now that version's worth a lot of money as well, and it became a racing game. But that's that. Yeah, if you've got a GameCube version you want to give to me, yeah, by all means, get hold of me.
That was a long one sentence.
It was.
Killer Instinct Gold.
Combo Breaker.
Earthbound 64, aka Earthbound 2, aka Mother 3.
Still waiting for the recreation.
Blast Core.
Why take a nuclear bomb through a city?
International Superstar Soccer 64.
Best football game of all time.
War Gods.
Nah.
FIFA Soccer 64.
Oh, possibly the worst football game of all time.
GoldenEye 007.
Iconic.
Top Gear Rally.
Underappreciated. Brilliant game.
Doom 64.
The best first-person shooter on this console.
You'll get emails. Rev Limit.
Ooh.
I think Rev Limit is the one we've discussed before between me and Luke, the game that never actually came out. It was the first racer announced for the N64,
It
never got released.
Yeah.
So I guess missing in action would be an appropriate summary.
Yes, it was.
Mortal Kombat Trilogy.
That stupid controller makes it horrible.
Wild Choppers.
No idea.
And okay, for the last little box out, under the also watch out for, one word summaries.
Go on.
Wayne Gretzky 3D.
Arguably. Well, no, sorry. The sequel, I'm going to tell you a little story. The sequel to that was the worst rated computer game on IGN. But it's a good game. Good.
One word is good.
Good.
Cool. The Glory of St. Andrews.
Oh. It's a 64DD game. I don't know. No idea.
Dual Heroes. Tetrisphere.
Oh, underrated.
F-Zero 64.
Banger.
Bomberman 64.
Oh, I'm going to give it two words. Prefer 2D.
Blade and Barrel.
No idea.
I thought that was an AEW tag team. The Barrel and the Blade. Ultra Descent.
No idea.
Basically, Descent 64.
Oh, Descent 64. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost misread this as Buggle Boogle, but it says Buggy Boogie.
Buggy Boogie. Buggy Boogie never came out.
They do say in this, no firm date for this Nintendo Driving Fest. Been in development for pigging ages.
No, never was launched, so nah.
Mission Impossible.
Oh, how do I just put that into a word?
Is it impossible?
Underrated again.
Lamborghini 64.
Oh, Titan, hate you.
I'll take that as a word. Multi-racing championship.
Oh, my first ever racing game I played for this console. I love it.
Sonic Wing Assault.
No idea.
Go Go Troublemakers.
No idea. Oh, Troublemakers. Oh, Mischief Makers. Oh, yeah. Is that Mischief Makers? Oh, shake. There you go.
Yeah, treasure, basically. Treasure being treasure.
Sorry. I just realised. It was like, oh, Mischief Makers. Ah, no, I love that game.
Clay Fighter 63 and a third.
Oh, famously, The sculptures cut's the most expensive game that you can buy on this console. It's got FOMG in it. Meh.
Quake 64.
Oh, spectacular.
Body Harvest.
Before its time.
Silicon Valley.
Buy it.
Two words, but given your inability to count beyond one most of the time.
I can't, especially with certain ones. I'm like, oh, how do I just keep that to one word?
Purchase.
Yeah, purchase. Okay. All right.
I use my big words.
I'm a big boy now.
It is a shame we only have 10 episodes of Games Master left at this point, because we've already had a good few years of the rise of the PlayStation, the death spiral of the Sega Saturn, the extinction of the Jaguar, and the what the hell do we even do with this of the Panasonic 3DO. And because it's a short series, and because Series 7 is very much the series that shouldn't have been, the Nintendo 64 is not as big a part of what time we have left here with Games Master as it could have been. It is a shame we're not going to get to explore more of the Nintendo 64's, unfortunately, very, very brief lifespan. I was actually looking up some details earlier, and technically this was discontinued before the PlayStation. Like, the PlayStation wasn't discontinued until shortly before the launch of the PlayStation 3. The PlayStation remained in active production all the way through its successor's lifespan because, of course, backward compatibility meant that they could sell games to the PlayStation. If someone bought a PS2, fine, they can carry the games over to it.
It was like overnight they just walked in and shut up shop on it. You know, the last game that was released for the N64 was in 2001. That was Tony Hawk's. Yeah, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3. And that was a game that came out a year before. If you look at, let's say, how us collectors and N64 enthusiasts, you know, 2 years ago, we saw someone find Dinosaur Planet. Now, Dinosaur Planet would later become Star Fox Adventures. So there were all these games that were literally overnight just gone, no, stop producing them for the N64. You now need to switch them over to the GameCube or Project Dolphin. You need to do that now because we are just going to switch off the lights and that's it. And because of that, you know, it's so sad that we lost a lot of those games. We lost a lot of games.
Yeah. Same with the Saturn as well, actually. If you look at where the Saturn just went, we're done.
Yeah.
Moving on to the Dreamcast. Both Nintendo and Sega were loss chasing because Nintendo came second in that particular console generation war.
Mm-hmm.
But in part, they only did because the Saturn crashed so badly, because they were last to the race. And it's a shame because I do have a lot of love for the Nintendo 64. There are a lot of games on it I truly adore to this day. The wrestling games on the Nintendo 64, for me, will never be surpassed as 3D wrestling games go. Prove me wrong, fight forever. Cliff, thanks so much for joining us, and then just joining me and stepping up and becoming not just part of a trio, but becoming the full-fledged co-host for this episode and just helping me muddle through this. Guys, you will never hear most of the stuff that we said. This is a 2-hour, 13-minute record, and by heckins, we've got some editing to do, if nothing, because this bugger right here can't just understand the concept of a single sentence.
Or word. Purchase. Anyway, it's an absolute honour being here. One, I'm really grateful for you giving me this opportunity because it is huge. For me, this is huge. This isn't just a podcast that I look up to. I'm a fan of this podcast. So to be on this, I've been podcasting for 10 years. This is one of my highlights. And to do it with yourself, you know, Ash, that I look up to you immensely. And it is always fascinating to see how much research you put into it. You put in the same effort as I do into waffling as you do into research. It is just absolutely phenomenal. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you to you. Thank you to Luke. And thank you to absolutely everyone who is still listening to me continue on waffling. I'll let you carry on.
If they want to hear more of your bird's eye potato waffles, they're waffly versatile. Where can they find you online?
It's N64 Life Podcast. That's on the old Twitter, Mastodon, Instagram, wherever you get your stuffs from, as well as the Twitch channel. I stream at 8:30 till 11 most Fridays, most Sundays. I stream the N64, but I have expanded a little bit. I have gone to the GameCube and the Game Boy Advance as well. But come and give that a watch, as well as N64 Life Podcast. It should be back by the time that you are listening to this, not if you're a patron. So please go and give it a listen. There should be a lovely episode up about the cluster. Try not to swear, no more editing. The lovely, delightful game that was Superman, The New Adventures of Superman, commonly known as Superman 64. So go and give that a listen. And if you want to find me, at The Amazing Cliff. But yeah, that's awesome. I've loved every second of this.
It has been a hoot.
A hoot.
But that about wraps it up for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with us and provide us with your thoughts of the launch of the Nintendo 64 or feedback for our upcoming Season 6 wrap-up episode, you can do so over on Twitter at UnderConsolePod, on Instagram at Under.Console, or via email feedback@underconsultation.com. You can also join us on our Discord, where there is a lot of excitement at the moment because we're in the final build-up to Under Consultation Live 2.0. And if you're hearing this on the Patreon feed, there is still time for you to get tickets and get on down to Croydon. We are not only doing a live podcast recording of the best of Games Master, kind of picking some of our favorite challenges from more across all 8 seasons, but then in the second half, we are recreating and in some cases enhancing some of those challenges. That's right, we are putting on live our very own Games Master tribute show. That's Saturday, 14th of January, 2023 in Croydon. All details are on our social media and tickets are available on our website, underconsultation.com. If you wish to support this podcast monetarily, you can do so over at our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/underconsolepod. At the £5 level, you get access to next week's episode 1 week early and ad-free. And at the £10 level, they get a little bit more. Don't they, Ash? That's right, Ash. They do, Ash. At the £10 level, one of the two Ashes will package up a mug, fill it with sweeties, fill it with stickers, fill it with badges, yeet it out the window, and hope a pigeon picks it up and drops it down your chimney.
And doesn't accidentally deliver it to the little old lady that lives opposite you.
To be more accurate, doesn't accidentally give the address of the little old lady that lives next to you.
All right, my
therefore,
bad.
Therefore, being self-fulfilling. But that is what those £10 backers get, and they also get their names read out right now. Let's see if I can do this in one take, because those £10 backers are Misha, William C, Gordon D, Adam D, the amazing Cliff, never heard of him, nope. Mark A, Sean Dunn, Nick L, Simon, Harriet Manga Girl, Matty Boo, David Palmer, Jamie Smith, Super Sexy Dave Fisher, Xanderthal, Kevin Kerr, Andrew Cummings, Richard Downer, Gordon Brunt, Link Campbell, Christian Din, Riss Wynn, Tom S, Andy Smith, Arcadia Wild, Bill, Ian Williams, I Am Cheadle, Selena B, N, Chris Price, Retro Fun for Everyone, and David White. One take.
Well done, sir.
That will do it for this week. We will see you in 7 days' time for another interstitial episode from the void that is Dominic Diamond's Mind Palace before we eventually get to the desert island. Take care, everyone.
Good night.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.